15.5 million yen. So, I mean, that would buy you, even in Tokyo, the yield would be lower and the building would be older and the unit would be smaller, but it would potentially buy you a unit in Tokyo. In other cities, depending on the city and the location, it could buy you one or two units. I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages to both in the sense that it gives you more diversity on the one hand, but lower quality property, lower quality tenants. It's still Japan. There's no ghettos or anything like that, but there's still, lower income tenants. They might turn over a bit more frequently. Occasionally, it doesn't happen much in Japan, but occasionally might have some payment issues. Quite rare, but possible.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so before we get right into today's episode, just a heads up for those listening in who are not living in Japan. We are off from today, 10th of August, or today as in when this episode was recorded, and all the way until the 20th for the annual Obon summer holiday. As is most of the rest of the country, this is one of those two or three times every year when things get very, very quiet, really dead here in Japan. So enjoy this sweltering summer heat. Get out to the beach if you know what's good for you. And we, as well as everybody else in Japan, will be back refreshed in about a week or 10 days' time. All right, so for today's episode, we're talking to a first-time buyer, again, who is in the process of kicking off his investment portfolio here, for the purpose of which he's planning to set up a local corporate entity for various reasons, which we'll get into in the conversation with him. One of the main ones being that he's hoping to establish a historical income stream here in the country, which will hopefully enable him down the track to also qualify for investment loans. So we talk a bit about that and what his options are in this regard, what's actually required for a non-resident in Japan to qualify for such a loan, if that's even possible. We then talk about the investments themselves, the sort of yields that he can expect in various locations around the country, including which ones of those locations would also work for short-term rentals specifically. How long should he hold the properties that he purchases? What types of properties make for good investments overall? And how would reselling them down the track work? We also talk a bit about tenants, how long are average tenancies in Japan, what are the advantages of purchasing a building as opposed to several condo units at the same budget, what are the best properties for short-term stay rentals, and finally, what's actually involved in setting up this corporate vehicle and starting to invest. We then lightly touch on leasehold properties as well, how common or uncommon those are in Japan, is there any situation in which they might make for a good investment. And finally, we review some potential listings together. And we also talk about what happens when properties get too old and are potentially purchased by developers from the existing owners in a case of a co-owned property. So really good, thorough conversation on all things investment related. Hopefully this brings some value to those among you who are also considering pulling the trigger on their first investment property purchase in Japan. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Cord. Okay. Now, let me just scroll back to our email because I've got no memory whatsoever. Give me a sec. Okay, so you're looking to set up a Japanese company to invest in Japanese real estate, essentially. Right. Do you want to give me a bit more of a background? Like, where are you at the moment? What's the idea behind it? Are you moving to Japan, in Japan?
Yeah, I'm in the Cayman Islands. I'm not moving to Japan anytime soon. If I did, it'd be in 5 to 10 years.
Okay.
I've still got kids, gonna have more kids. And so this is just basically an investment vehicle to be investing passively as possible from overseas so that I can build a portfolio over there. And over time, if it grows big enough and I have a big enough monthly income from it, maybe I can one day put myself as the business manager of the company, get the business manager visa, and immigrate to Japan.
So that's down the track once the company's got a track record and income history and so forth.
That's right.
Okay, so you know that you're not eligible for financing before you get that visa, or alternatively partner with a Japanese executive director. I mean
Right.
Japanese partner and set them up as executive director of the company, and then you might be eligible a few years down the track.
Right. Yeah. This would be as much cash only purchases, one or two properties a year as, my income will allow, and just build like that. And I know that there's some banks, I think it's like Shinsei Bank, that maybe does some financing,
For
and some
non-residents,
financing
you mean?
stuff. Yes, for non-residents.
Shinsei Investment and Finance do, which is not Shinsei Bank, it's a subsidiary of Shinsei Bank. Kind of convoluted process. They can't even help you open a bank account with Shinsei Bank. They send people to us to help them open bank accounts in other banks, which is a bit weird. But they would potentially give you a loan, but only for super central properties in two or three major cities. So you won't be able to get very creative with that. But you've mentioned passive in any case. So you're just looking at long-term leases, I would assume, right? Residential or commercial or whatnot.
Any sort of short-term minpaku stuff, from what I've seen, it's you got to be very involved.
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
So I think it would all end up being long-term stuff, and unless I could get a partner that would want to be more involved, and
Okay.
that lives in, so.
Understood. And so, okay. So, in that case, most major metro centers, I'll put Tokyo aside for a moment because budget wise and yield wise, it's probably not super attractive. Most other major metropolitan centers would generate something like 4 or 5% before tax. If you get out to like prefectural capitals, like the biggest city in an otherwise rural prefecture or a bedroom community, let's say within an hour from major cities, then maybe up to six and a bit. But then you kind of lose. I don't want to say lose because it has been good in the last few years, but you have much less of a chance of gaining any capital appreciation the further you get out of city centers, right? But
That
otherwise, you
makes
mentioned a
sense.
budget, I think, for about 100K US a year, roughly, right? So that is in Japanese yen at the moment, that's about 15 and a half million yen. So, I mean, that would buy you even in Tokyo. The yield would be lower and the building would be older and the unit would be smaller, but it would potentially buy you a unit in Tokyo. In other cities, depending on the city and the location, it could buy you one or two units. I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages to both in the sense that it gives you more diversity on the one hand, but lower quality property, lower quality tenants. It's still Japan, there's no ghettos or anything like that, but there's still, lower income tenants. They might turn over a bit more frequently. Occasionally, it doesn't happen much in Japan, but occasionally might have some payment issues. Quite rare, but possible. So that would. In each of the other cities, let's say the top seven, so Kyoto, Osaka, Fukuoka, Yokohama, and some of the bigger, smaller city, let's call them tier two cities like Chiba, Saitama City, Kobe City, those kinds of locations, that would probably buy you 2 units if you wanted, or one higher end unit. And we would normally aim the sweet spot for both yield, but on the other hand, having the building not age too quickly on you, and make sure that building fees don't go through the roof very frequently. Probably the sweet spot is 20 to 30 years old on purchase. And then as it if it's closer to 30 years, then within 6, 7 years, you might want to consider to cycle, resell it, and buy something a little bit newer. So once it approaches the 40-year age mark is when building fees start to go up, because the building requires a lot more maintenance and repairs. And then investor, because you're going to be buying primarily investment units, in the sense that they'd very rarely be purchased by owners occupiers. So people who can afford to buy them wouldn't want to live in them because they're old and small, and vice versa, the tenants would never be able to afford to buy them outright. So because they're strictly investment properties from a buyer's perspective, they'll always be priced based on the investment yield that they generate. So other investors buying from you, as the building approaches 40 years, they're also very aware that they're going to be reducing their yield soon as building fees go up. So probably around 37, 36, 37 years of age is when we'll consider reselling them, so that you can retain most of your capital if possible. So if you buy 20 to 30 years, that gives you somewhere between 10 to 15 years. Sorry, between 6 to 16 years, to then get your rental income up, so that you're well in the green, even if the property value drops a little bit by the time you sell it.
Okay, so this is the typical long-term investment strategy, buying these like 1K mansion in the city
Oh,
centers.
depends on the city. Sometimes we'd be able to squeeze a family-sized unit into it, but family-sized units, I mean, again, pros and cons. So family tenants stay longer than singles or couples. So the average for singles or couples is 4 to 5 years. Average for family tenants is more like 8 to 10 years. And they tend to take slightly better care of the property than singles and couples. But when you do need to renovate between tenants, you've got a bigger floor space, so the renovation costs a bit more. And also, they're a little bit. Vacancies can be a little bit longer because Japan's population trend being what it is, it's always a lot easier to find singles and couples without kids than it is to find families. But there again, advantages and disadvantages to both. I mean, family tenants are nice and stable. Even if the yield's a little bit lower, they stay longer in place, and you don't have, from a passive investment kind of perspective, you have less hands-on that you would have with tenant turnover with singles and couples. But if you could save more, let's say you were to save that kind of amount for 2, 2.5 years, you could buy a small building, which is the best of all worlds, because that gives you a larger land plot, which stands to gain more in value. In Japan, basically, the only thing that would gain potentially in value is the land. So you get a larger land plot, and you have the flexibility, because there's no owner union, you're in charge of the building, everything's on you. You have the flexibility to maybe get creative down the track if you wanted. Not necessarily short-term stays, but you could more easily rent out, for example, to commercial tenants. Some of the mansion buildings would allow that, but that's more the rarity than the norm. Normally, it's strictly residential. And also, not necessarily short-term stay, but you could also do monthly rentals, which, you know, are kind of medium, both yield-wise and hassle-wise, kind of between long-term rentals and short-term rentals. But they also don't require any special licensing, which the short-term rentals do. So if you own the entire building, you've just got more flexibility. And, you know, if it gets too old, you can always tear it down, rebuild, turn it into a parking lot, whatever you want to do.
And are these buildings, what's kind of the minimum size that you would see? Would you see like 4 units, or what is that rare than like 12 unit
Some of
blocks?
them are even just 2 or 3 units. So, for example, two on the ground floor and one bigger one on the second floor. But normally they'd, yes, normally they'd be somewhere, I mean, at the budget that we're talking about, which is, let's say, starting at around 40, 45 million yen. So that's about 300 something US at the moment. They'll be somewhere between 4 to 8 units typically. So 2 or 3 floor, wooden or steel framed wood structure. And in those cases, we'd advise to buy something that's 20 years and younger because wood deteriorates more quickly than concrete.
Okay.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
Okay. So those are the two viable strategies for passive investment, I would say, either mansion units, separate mansion units, or a small building.
I've watched quite a few of your podcasts. And I watched one today with Tracy Northcott talking about she said she had no limit on budget, she would buy a building just like you're talking about, and you have the flexibility, like you said, of doing short-term rentals in there.
Yes.
And Emil was also on the podcast with you guys and was saying that he had some investment units in a building that he had a special agreement that he could short-term rental them, but typically that you don't see that.
Very rare. Very, very rare. Yeah. Normally you'd own the entire structure if you want to do that. So there are definitely companies and individuals buying buildings and turning the whole building into short-term stay. But to get the owner union to agree to that in a co-owned building is very, very challenging. 99% of them will say no to that. I mean, according to the legislation, they have to specifically put it into the owner union rule book that they allow that. And it's very, very rare that they do.
Japan doesn't like change, so yeah.
Japan doesn't like change. They, I'm politely saying foreigner shy, not to say racist. So, you know, foreigners coming in and out at strange hours of the night is a big no-no for most Japanese buildings, for most Japanese tenants anyway, or unit owners. So it's very challenging, yeah. But if you are planning to go the short-term stay route potentially in the future, I would aim for family-sized units or at least large couple-sized units, because there's a lot more demand for those in the market. There's so many studios in one case for rent for a short-term stay, not many family-sized.
Okay, and I've seen I typed in a search, you know, limit 100,000 and you know single room in central Tokyo, and several pop up. And they have this, they'll say yield 5.63%. And I know you can't exactly take that, you know, on its surface. You know,
when you're looking at condo units on the Japanese property websites, I would take at least 3-4% off the yield that you're seeing there. When you're looking at a building, it's a little bit closer to reality, but with mansion units, at least 3%, because they don't factor in the purchase costs. They don't factor in the property management costs, and that all takes about 3-4% off the yield.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And as when I spoke with the immigration lawyer Hiroshi Shimizu a couple of days ago, and talking about business setup, and I don't know if I heard this on your podcast or if I'm getting it mixed up, but one of the things he said to do was to that it's impossible to get a corporate bank account if you don't already have a individual bank account in Japan.
That's, yeah, that probably not on the podcast, but that's quite correct. Yes.
And so anyways, he his
No, I mean,
solution to that was
if you're the sole owner of the business, yes. But again, if you've got a company with a Japanese resident, long-term resident, or permanent resident, or national as your executive director, representative director, then that becomes a bit easy. But I mean, yeah, I guess it's the same thing because they'll be looking at his individual history, right? And he would have a personal bank account, he, she. So kind of, but there are, I mean, it takes a lot of, I've got another company that helps people with that kind of thing. It takes a lot of trial and error and hits and misses. And it is possible, essentially. With the online banks, it is becoming a little bit easier. They're a lot less strict than the traditional brick and mortar Japanese banks, but easy, it's definitely not.
And that was his solution was, you know, SBI Shinsei, or that, which is an online bank, and he named a few others, but it
Shinsei
was
is not
like,
an, I don't think Shinsei is an online bank. SBI, Sony Bank, PayPay Bank, GMO, Aozora, Shumi. There's one that our other company has an account with. I forget the name. Sumishin, also an online bank. There's a bunch of them, and they're a bit more lenient than traditional Japanese banks, but still easy. It's never easy. Even for Japanese residents, if they're opening a new company and they don't have a track record as anything except a salaryman individual, even for Japanese nationals, it's difficult. It's challenging. Yeah. But again, online
and in
banks
the U.S.
are a lot easier.
I'm trying to figure out the whole landscape of opening a business, and it seems like just so many hoops to jump through.
Well, setting up the company itself is really easy. Shimizu-san can do that for you within a month. But everything else, office lease, bank account, any kind of relationships with Japanese business partners, that's all a bit challenging for foreigners and even more so for non-resident foreigners. Yeah. I hope we'll get there someday, but Japan takes a long time to change.
I mean, that's the right where I'm at is just opening this. I couldn't get a straight answer whether I should buy the property as an individual first and put it into the company as my version of paid-in capital, or open the company first and then buy the
Well,
property through.
the main thing to consider there is that when you'll transfer ownership from individual to corporate ownership, you'll need to pay the entire legal and registration fees again, which is, depending on the price of the property, somewhere between, let's say, 1 to 5%. So if that's not prohibitive, then both work. But I mean, setting up the company, putting your capital into the company, just showing that you have the capital in your overseas bank account, and then using that money to purchase the property, that would also qualify as the investment required. I don't think you need to have it individually before to prove anything. You can just show, I mean, you're the sole owner of the company, I would assume. So anything that you show that is individually under your name, like the capital, it doesn't have to be the property, that the bank would, sorry, not the bank, the immigration department would look at that as capital invested in the company. So that shouldn't be an issue.
That's good to know. I don't know if I have any more questions related to long term. I'm trying to look at my notes here on my phone. Oh yeah, so I saw a few listings that it would look like a good deal, and then it would say this property is leasehold only and the lease expires in 2045.
Even if the lease doesn't expire, I mean, there's two, I can't remember which is which, but there's old lease law, leasehold law, and new leasehold law. One of them kind of guarantees perpetual extensions of the lease. But there are other factors aside from potentially losing the land that come into play. So, number one is that you have zero capital growth potential because you own no land whatsoever. And the other thing is that banks will not lend for leasehold properties. So if and when you want to resell, you're limited to cash buyers. So I wouldn't, unless there's a very compelling reason to, I probably wouldn't look at those.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm working from home today. There might be a few cats crossing the screen at some point.
All the best deals I saw were like it'd be, $56,000 for this, small home in the middle of Tokyo, and then it would say this property is leasehold only. And
Yeah.
yeah, I knew there was a catch to that.
Not very attractive, I would say. I mean, they make for good deals. That's why the price is reduced. So if you're purely looking at cash flow and you're okay with just riding it till it drops kind of thing, that might be doable. But otherwise, if you're thinking about future potential of doing something with the property, I wouldn't look at those. And also,
Yeah,
I
any.
wouldn't, you said homes as in houses, single family homes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
this is a single family home.
Unless you're going the short-term stay route, I would not do that unless it's a brand new home or very close to it. Hey, go away, go away. No, dude, go away. Sorry. Because they're not really built to last in Japan, not very durable building materials for these old homes. And I'm assuming based on your budget, it's probably going to be something that is at least 30, 40 years old. You can. Even assuming it passes a structural inspection and there's no major issues that you need to consider, just annual maintenance and repairs, you should factor in something like 2 to 4,000 bucks a year. And it comes and goes, right? So it's very unstable compared to other types of properties. So you'll have 5, 6 years where everything's okay, and then the roof goes for 3 million yen or I mean, I unless you're okay with these kind of swings ups, I mean. They make sense if you're either a hands-on DIY type investor and can get these jobs done efficiently and cheaply, and or you're strictly going the short-term stay route, and then yes, there's definitely value in having your own structure, a house that you can deck out the way you want, cater specifically to a niche market of guests. Then it makes sense, but for the type of passive investment that you're describing, I'd probably steer clear of those.
Yeah, I think definitely it makes it way less passive. Yeah, any issues like that. And I own my home here, and there's always something to do. Roof,
Exactly. Yeah.
AC going
And
out, plumbing.
even more so here because they're really not built to last in Japan. I don't know what the Cayman Islands are like, but most Western countries that I've looked at, and even some of the Asian countries, houses are built a lot sturdier than here. I don't know if
Yeah,
it's a combination of,
imagine.
I'm guessing it's a combination of earthquake, thinking about potential earthquake damages, and also kind of, Japanese like everything new. So it's kind of assumed every 30 years you buy a new house or practically rebuild it from the ground up. So they're just not built to last.
No, yeah. I was just saying, yeah, 2 square foot place is a lot less just square footage to deal with than a whole house, 700, 800 square feet, in terms of maintenance.
Yes, definitely.
So
But I
when
mean,
you do go wrong, it's much
again,
less to
pros and
fix.
cons, right? 18, 20 square meter apartment gets you pretty low-end tenants.
Was 200 square feet in 12 minutes from Hiro Station, in Minami Azabu, and 1995 the building was completed, so less than 30 years old, and is for sale for 96,000 US. I think it was 14 and a half million yen, and I thought that was a decent deal. I wouldn't know
It
all of
is.
it.
It is. It would always be occupied, not by the highest quality tenants, but you always find someone to rent it. I doubt it'll stay vacant for more than a couple of months at a time between tenants. We have a few customers with a similar, even smaller apartment, actually, like actually 13 square meters, which is basically just place for a bed. That's about it. And it's never stood empty for longer than a month because of the location. It's just smack in the center of the city, and it always gets populated. Again, not the highest quality tenants, but they're always there.
And I saw another one. It was Central Shinjuku, 50,000 US dollars, and it was 100 square feet. And it was six, it looks like six units in this building. And
Well, that's kind of a dormitory type arrangement, right? Like a little capsule, and then you maybe share toilets and bathroom with the other tenants, kind of.
be back.
I think we are. Sorry about that. I'm not sure what's happening today. Sorry. So
Was
you
that? I don't know if
think
it's my.
about that tiny 9 square meter apartment. Is that like a dormitory situation where they share bathrooms and toilets and stuff?
No, it's got its own bath
Where?
and
Okay.
toilets and little teeny tiny. Let me try to pull it up. I've actually got a subscription to Akiamart, so it's on my saved list, saved homes.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akia, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiamart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily, ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties. Akiamart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiamart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akia-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akia-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
I can tell you where it is. Give me a second to find it. It is.
Quick plug for Akiyama. They do a good job, don't they?
It's 5 Chome Nakano-ku. Okay, so maybe not Shinjuku, but let me put on the Google Maps
Nakano
here.
is pretty damn good, though.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's right. I mean, it's like literally one street across the from the Shinkansen. I'll mail this to you, this listing. And I mean, I didn't really look too deeply into it. It's, but for the price and the location, I mean, it's teeny tiny, but that's the best priced thing in that good of an area that I've seen. So anyways, I just emailed it to you.
I'm looking at it now. I don't know where you'd fit a toilet and shower and anything as small as that. That's interesting though. Hang on. Let me open up the agent's website. So let me share my screen so we're looking at the same thing. Oh, 1978. That's ancient though, man. I mean, not ancient,
Yeah.
but you know what I mean? It's not. It's gonna
Not
take
very.
some pretty serious maintenance very soon. I'm trying to see, where do you see the size?
It was on the Akiamart website. It just said 100 square feet, 110 maybe.
And the sheen. I'm not seeing that anywhere though. Let me just go English. Maybe I'm looking at something. Oh yeah, 10.21 square. Yeah, that's tiny. Okay. I guess you could put a futon here. I don't know.
Yeah.
It looks like the type of place that only hungry students would be renting out, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
Literally
like
a bedroom.
if I bought it, I probably wouldn't even rent it because the return wouldn't be great. It just to kind of hold it as a place to stay when in Tokyo, or friends and family go visit. Be like, here, you can stay here.
Yeah,
And
I mean, the return is, what's the return? Is it tenanted at the moment, by the way?
5% ROI.
Oh, it is tenanted. Okay. So 600,000. Let me just quickly run that one. So 8 million. Let's say worst case, 15% purchase costs. That's 9.2 in total. And then you're getting 600,000 divided by 12. That's 50,000 minus the 5,000 management fee and the 5,100 reserve funds contribution. So you're making 39,900. Sorry, I forgot to take off the property management fee. So 50,000 minus property management fees minus 10,100, 37,150 a month net. So 445,800 a year divided by purchase price of 9.2 in total. Close to 5%, actually. That's not bad for Tokyo. It's pretty good for Tokyo, but I'm just wondering how easy it is to get tenants for anything as tiny as that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's enough social kudanshi,
Yeah.
hikikomori, I would live there. TV, bed, $300 a month.
Yeah. Tokyo's expensive, eh? For this kind of price, you'd get close to a 1DK in most areas in Fukuoka where we're renting out to people.
Really? Wow.
I'm just concerned because building fees are really low on this one, especially the reserve fund. If the building was built in 1978, I'm very much assuming they'll be close to double in the near future, which would reduce your yield significantly.
And I know it's good to be really close to train stations, but being that close to the Shinkansen, I mean,
The
with the
type of
noise.
tenants you have in these units don't really give a shit. Yeah. For them, the convenience of being close to the station beats everything else. I mean, you can imagine anyone who lives in a place like that is really just going there to sleep, right? It's not like they're going to do anything else with the apartment.
Anyways, that's the best price and the best location, but
But
yeah,
there's a
TV time.
reason for that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I so if there was an issue or a scenario in which the owners got together and they said we want to demolish it and build something else, or some investor came in and did that, and you owned that unit, would you be kind of forcibly bought out, or would you be compensated with square footage in the new building?
It really depends on what the developer can build on it. The less they can build on it, because current zoning regulations are always going to be stricter than when the building was constructed. If they can't build anything of equal number of units there, then they're obviously going to try to pay you as little as they can, because they're definitely not going to give you a new unit. And that's going to be the case in most big city locations, especially for anything as old as that. So what they normally do is they need to get 80% agreement from the owner union to sell the building to them. So if you happen to be one of the 20% who refused when they finally convinced everyone to do it, then you'll still be owning the apartment. They're not going to tear the building down under you, but they are within their rights to stop provision of power, water. So essentially, you're left with something that you can't really do anything. And at that time, you'll just be giving it away to them. So, you normally, if and when that happens, you'll just take whatever offer they give you, which is going to be close to your purchase price, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more. And yeah. just settle for that.
Yeah, I was just saying that going outside of the outside of Tokyo, things just get exponentially better. Like you're saying, Fukuoka's, I know it's grown a lot and prices are going up, but for
Still got a lot of
50,000
room to
yen.
grow compared to Tokyo and Osaka, although it is getting pretty close to Osaka, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know for capital appreciation in Tokyo versus these, growing cities like Fukuoka.
Percentage-wise, like if you look at the graph, Fukuoka has been growing as fast as Tokyo and Osaka, actually a little bit faster sometimes, percentage-wise. Like during COVID, it was one of the only places that still continued to gain in value slightly. But it still has a lot of room to grow before it reaches Tokyo levels.
Yeah, definitely.
Otherwise, Kyoto always appreciates slowly but surely. Sapporo, I mean, it gets a few years where it goes stagnant, but usually appreciates slowly and surely. Central Yokohama, because Yokohama is it's Japan's second biggest city, but most of it is very suburban. So anywhere within 2, 3 stations from Yokohama Station always goes up in value. Saitama City has been going up in value nicely. Again, all the places we mentioned, Kobe, Chiba, but the fastest growing ones are Tokyo, Osaka, and Fukuoka.
And I guess just like you're drawing concentric circles around central Tokyo and you're hitting Yokohama and Saitama and is it Kanazawa as well?
Chiba, Kawasaki first, but Kawasaki is very similar to Tokyo already. I wouldn't count it as a different city, real estate trend wise.
Yeah, I've looked at Atami and Chiba and Yokohama as well.
I like
It's
Saitama specifically because the population there is on the rise as well, whereas Chiba tends to be a bit stagnant. It's a
okay.
smaller city compared to Chiba, but it's closer to Tokyo and it's more popular with younger people.
Yeah, I've been to Chiba once. But
Not
yeah, it's
exciting.
Not a lot going on.
No. I was staying there. I viewed some properties for a customer there a couple of months ago, and I stayed in a hotel smack on top of Chiba Station, and even then, I went out at night. There was a couple of restaurants open, some girl bars, and that was it. This city that fun forgot.
I went down the road of Akiya in the Inaka. I had a conversation with Matt from Akiya Inaka. Back in the day, and I lived in the country in Texas on 5 acres, and that idyllic homesteading stuff, and you do kind of get bored out in the country unless you've got a lot of DIY hobbies and stuff like that to keep you occupied. So I've kind of shifted my focus to more city stuff or like close enough to conveniences to make life to have fun
Yeah, I
on a
agree.
day-to-day.
Before we moved to Japan, my last 2 years in Australia were in a beautiful town, but tiny, tiny rural area, and 2 years was enough, man.
That was 2 years in Texas in the hill country. Not a lot going on, a lot of deer, but not a lot else.
But the drives are beautiful. Every time you drive in and out of home, it's gorgeous, right?
I was on 5 acres. It was great. It was awesome. But you miss nice restaurants and nightlife and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in web solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company Innovatius is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top of the list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing per-project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $297 per month, period. And if that's not enough, if you mention that you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you wish, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob at robert@innovatius.com. That's INNOVACIOUS.com. And his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to lift your website's appeal and visitor numbers, and provide you with an easy-to-read, detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
If I was in Japan, I'd be doing short-term rentals for sure. And I had this idea that I would have, you know, vacation homes, Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka, Fukuoka, somewhere in Hokkaido. And then I could rent them out for the 180-day minpaku, and then the rest of the year either do the month-long stays or just traveling between the houses with the family. And
to be said for Chiba City and Osaka City specifically is that they're designated special zones for minpaku, which means you can actually rent out throughout the year there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. First time I've heard that. I thought everything. Yeah, I know that like Minato-ku it's like 90 days out of the year, and other wards are, you know, weekends only or holidays only, that kind of thing.
Yeah. In Tokyo, each ward office sets their own thing, but Osaka City, Chiba City, it's citywide, and they're both designated minpaku friendly.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. You said Osaka and Chiba or Kyoto
Chiba.
As well?
Yeah, Chiba City. Not the entire prefecture, just Chiba City.
Okay. But not Kyoto?
No, Kyoto is one of the strictest for minpaku. They've had enough of tourists over there.
Yeah, I also got obsessed with the Kyomachiya stuff, but again, don't want to deal with all the maintenance headaches and possible fires you could have with those.
You can make a very decent buck if you manage to get a license in Kyoto. It's very much in demand most of the year.
Mm. Okay.
They're renting out for hundreds and hundreds of dollars a night, much higher than other places. But again, it's near impossible to get a license there these days. We've got one customer who does not short-term, but monthly rentals in Kyoto. And he's been on fairly full occupancy to the point where he can't even use it when he comes there.
Wow.
But it's it has to be monthly. It's not going to be minpaku.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I see in like a Hachise real estate, they always do them, you know, month-long stays. That's all they advertise. So I guess that's why.
Yes. Yes. We just started working with them recently too. They're a good company. I like their style. They focus on nice properties. They don't even bother with the little shitty ones, and they're very quick on their feet. I just had a week-long tour with an agent, with one of their agents and a customer there, and I was suitably impressed.
Yeah, I spoke with them about a year ago, looking at some properties, and they've got a great company. Like I said, I've gone down the road of Akia and, you know, short-term rental stuff and all these different things. And unless I'm in Japan, it only makes sense to do this sort of passive, the real estate investing has to be as passive as possible. And the model seems to be long-term, buying either the family home style or these, mansion.
Yeah, definitely while you're still out of the country. I mean, when you're here and if your business is to be running the real estate asset management company, like you said, then it starts making sense. But remotely, I mean, we do it for customers that have a holiday home and want to try to like cover costs while they're not using it, but that's about it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, man.
Having said that, Tracy does that for a lot more people who are doing it a lot more professionally.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. But yeah, you would need to, even if there's someone like Tracy managing it for you, you still need the mental bandwidth to constantly be on top of it, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I can get to Japan, you know, 1 or 2 months out of the year and focus on business in that way, and then maybe I could make that work.
Mm.
Yeah, that's something to consider. I'm going to Japan at end of May, and
okay,
so
nice.
I'll be going around Tokyo and stuff. So, yeah.
Don't be shy to drop by Fukuoka. I mean, it's not a drop by; it's the other side of the country, but it's a very nice city, especially when once it gets warmer like now.
Oh yeah, I've been through Fukuoka before. I studied abroad in Oita when I was in high school, so familiar with that area.
Very cool. That's where the Akiya Mart lads have purchased a home. That's what got them into the whole Akiya thing.
Yeah. I remember their presentation talking about that. I don't know if it was Beppu or Oita City, but
Beppu, yeah, not in Oita City. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, man. I love onsen. So when I was talking about that with Akiya Inaka, we were looking at it was a hotel. In it was bankrupt in Gunma, and it was selling for a really good price. But it was an onsen hotel, so
yeah.
But in the Inaka for sure.
Yeah.
Anyways, if I'm wanting to, I guess, get your services on, you know, so I can, if I see a property, I can move forward quickly. What's the process there?
So we are now in the midst of the perfect storm of being swamped with customers and moving office and having lost 2 staff members and recruiting and training 4 new staff members. So we're not going to be onboarding for full facilitation until July, August. Okay. But what if you want to pull the trigger before then, I'm happy to put you in touch with a super foreigner friendly agent, probably the one I'm thinking of, probably based in Tokyo, but she works all over the country. And then the logistics of the purchase should be able to do for you same as we would have done. So everything will be done remotely in English, and she'll make sure that you point her at the property, she helps you buy it. But the kind of strategic conversations we've been having, she's not going to have with you. So I can come in as consultant for a few $100, just make sure guiding her and asking the right questions for due diligence, reviewing documents before you sign them, raising red flags, that kind of thing.
Okay, great. If I had the property in mind that I was like, this is the one, then yeah, definitely. But I could probably wait a few more months, especially going to Japan in May. I'll kind of want to get a lay of the land before I move forward with anything.
Within a few months, we should be back in the saddle, so we'll be able to do everything for you.
Nice. That's good to hear. All right. Well, yeah, thanks so much for taking this call with me. And sorry, I couldn't make it on the first one the other day.
No, no problems. I know. I remember those sweet years when my son was young. Now he's an annoying teenager. But sorry about the internet quality. I'll try to get that sorted by next time we speak.
Yeah, no worries. No worries at all. I guess we'll be in touch then.
Sounds good. Talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye.
So there you have it. A quick but thorough Japan real estate investment 101 kind of session. Okay, maybe 201. Hope this strikes a chord with some of you out there who are in the same boat. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com.
And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku!